From National Public Radio, this is Latino USA.
Tonight on the Money Program, we're going to look at money. Lots of it. Some of it in nice piles, others in lovely clanky bits of loose change.
Loose change. Money. Dinero. It can bring a smile to your face, and as they say, it does make the world go around. But for the families of millions of immigrants to the United States, remittances, the money they send to their home countries, is serious business.
Right now, I just send a little bit left because, you know, the job is slowed down. Every job is going slow now, everywhere. Everybody have problems.
This week on our program, the immigrant economy, remittances on the decline, and a conversation with the stars of the Broadway musical In the Heights, just nominated for a breakthrough 13 Tony Awards.
It's amazing that we're on Broadway, but it feels like home on Broadway. There's nothing like it.
Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Three Mexican police chiefs from border cities have requested political asylum in the United States. Here to discuss the news of the week, I'm joined by Latino USA's senior producer, Alex Avila. Hey, Alex.
Hey, Maria.
I have to say, when I first read about this, I kind of was scratching my head. I don't know how often it is that Mexican police officials are seeking political asylum in the United States. So what's the basis of their asylum request, and do you think it'll go through?
Well, yeah, it is an unusual situation. Actually, the basis of their request is basically the volatile nature of their positions as police officials in these regions where police are being targeted for death. Officials with Customs and Border Protection told the Associated Press that they've interviewed these police chiefs and that their cases are under review. They're entitled to an asylum hearing, and they're going to go through the process with them. And all this has to do, of course, with the drug-related violence that we're seeing in Mexico along the border regions. When President Felipe Calderon took office in December 2006, he sent thousands of soldiers and federal police to areas where the government had essentially lost control. And these cartels have reacted with this unprecedented violence, and police have been the target of much of these violence. These police chiefs sort of appeared. They didn't come as a group. They individually crossed. They felt that they were in danger, and they asked for political asylum, and it really remains to be seen whether it's going to be granted.
Has anything like this ever happened before? Have you had something, a similar kind of political asylum request?
There have been individual cases of these. Political asylum from Mexico is rare, but it does happen from time to time. We can see small cases on an individual basis. It's not a large-scale thing at all.
Let's move on to this story, Alex. Many Americans last week received notice about rebate checks, part of the economic stimulus package that was passed by Congress and signed by President Bush. But it seems, interestingly, that the anti-immigrant provisions written into this law could actually sting some people here. So clear this story up for us, Alex.
Well, the law as it was written, it requires that you have a Social Security number in order to be eligible to receive your economic stimulus, your tax rebate. A lot of the anti-immigrant groups like FAIR lobbied for this because they were worried. They didn't want the possibility of undocumented immigrants to get access to these tax rebates. So if you were married to somebody without a Social Security number and you filed jointly, millions of people did and hundreds of thousands of our military personnel did, then you're not entitled to these rebates. A lot of the people that are affected are, in fact, legal residents with their green cards. They have an IRS-issued taxpayer identification number instead of a Social Security number. And, in fact, many of the people are in the pipeline for citizenship. But as you know, there is a backlog for citizenship. And so even groups like FAIR said this was an unintended consequence of trying to target undocumented immigrants.
Yeah, well, has FAIR at all said that they apologize for this or that they made a mistake in this?
Yeah, they've come out and said, you know, that if you're married to a U.S. citizen or if you're married to a military, that these non-citizens should be entitled, and, you know, and they're calling for maybe changes in the law, but it really is too late at this point. The law is just not written very well.
All right, Alex, let's talk a little bit about Arizona. We've mentioned the sheriff there. His name is Joe Arpaio. He's been on this crusade that we've talked about, basically in the Phoenix area, to hunt down what he calls illegal aliens. Governor Janet Napolitano from Arizona is not renewing the state funding for the sheriff's controversial immigration sweeps. The sheriff is saying that this is all about dirty politics. Is it, Alex?
Well, if it's immigration related these days, I mean, politics are involved. The sheriff had a contract with the state of Arizona to do these immigration enforcement sweeps. And Sheriff Arpaio basically created a posse to go out and round up illegal immigrants, as he called them. One of the criticisms of Arpaio is that on his desk, he's left literally thousands of unserved felony notices. And the criticism is he's out there chasing illegal immigrants instead of serving these warrants for felony arrests. What Governor Napolitano is doing is she's creating a multi-agency task force to focus on violent repeat criminals with felony warrants. So you can see there's this overlap. He's being criticized for not going strongly enough after felony offenders, and she's creating a task force to go after felony offenders. And to help fund that, she's pulling the plug on the money that would normally go to the sheriff's department for this controversial immigration raid. So that's where they're talking about dirty politics. And then one thing to remember, Maria, is Sheriff Arpaio's a Republican. He's sort of become a hero of the anti-immigrant crowd in Arizona. Janet Napolitano's a Democrat. You know, she'll be up for re-election soon, so we may not have heard the end of this.
All right, Alex. Well, thanks for joining us.
Okay, Maria. Thanks.
Alex Avila is senior producer of NPR's Latino USA. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Imagine that you're the breadwinner of a large extended family. Imagine that your paycheck is crucial to their well-being. Sounds familiar, right? But now imagine that your family doesn't live with you, that you're a stranger in a strange land, and that your family is back in Mexico or Nicaragua or Colombia.
My name is Oswaldo Urbina, and I live in San Francisco. I send money to Nicaragua like every 2 weeks, $300, $400 a week, every 2 weeks. It goes to my wife and my daughter.
Okay, my name is Jose Olivares. I'm from Guadalajara, Jalisco. Now I live in North Lake. I send money back. No, for now. Not so often, but something two or three times a year. For now, the economy is, the economy is a little low. It's bad. But still, for me, it's remained the same salary. It's not affecting too much, but a lot of people is affecting.
Mi nombre es Luz Blanco. Soy dominicana. Vivo aquí en Nueva York, en Queens, en Corona.
My name is Luz Blanco, and I'm Dominican. I live in Queens and work as a cashier in an agency for money transfer. I would say that compared to years past, people are sending less money home, both in the amount they send and not as often. People that used to send money every week now send it every 2 weeks, and it's always less money. I also get a lot of complaints that it's more expensive now to send money. The company's costs have gone up, so we charge more. They still send because they have family that depends on them, but everything from food to transportation is up. The salaries are the same.
Pero realmente están limitados porque ha subido la comida, ha subido el transporte, y los sueldos siguen iguales.
Remittances, the money sent by immigrants in the United States to their home countries, are a lifeline for millions of families in Latin America. A total of $45 billion was remitted to the region in 2006, nearly equal to the combined gross domestic product of Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. For years, the Inter-American Development Bank has been tracking remittances to Latin America, with the help of pollster Sergio Bendixson, who joins us now from Florida. Welcome back to our program, Sergio.
Thank you very much, Maria. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so for years, the amount of money being sent to Latin America essentially seemed to be increasing exponentially. You know, a few years ago, we'd be here and we'd be saying that it was $20 billion and we'd be amazed. Now, all of a sudden, it's skyrocketed to $45 billion. And some had even predicted that maybe $100 billion in the future. But now there's a sudden decline. What's happening, Sergio?
That's right. The so-called river of gold is beginning to experience some trouble. It may actually turn out to be an ocean of tears for millions of families in Latin America that will no longer be receiving remittances. And what has happened is that two very important dynamics have combined in the United States to cause, for the first time in history, a decrease in the amount of money being sent to Mexico and other countries. Number one, obviously the economic downturn in the United States has made the economic situation of many of these immigrant families more difficult. But more importantly, our studies indicate that we now have a fear factor, that millions and millions of Latin American families in the United States feel apprehensive about their future. They don't know whether they're going to be welcome in the United States in the long-term future. They're concerned about whether they're going to be able to remain in their apartment. They're concerned about whether they'll be able to find work. They're concerned about the way they're being treated by people. They complain about discrimination, being treated without respect. I think that has resulted in many of these families who don't know what's going to happen to them in the near future, basically saying, well, I maybe should hang on to my money this month and I won't be able to help my family back in Latin America because I may very well need it over the next few months.
So just how dependent are Latin Americans on the money that's being sent from the north to the south?
We estimate that at the very least 20 million people in Mexico, for example, are dependent on remittances and that at least 4 or 5 million of them will not be receiving remittances this year. And many of them will fall below the poverty line, which means they will not be able to afford three meals a day. They may not be able to afford the basic necessities of life, like housing and medicine. And therefore, it is a very, very difficult situation for millions of families in countries like Mexico. But in other countries, like the Dominican Republic, even Honduras and El Salvador, a lessening of the remittances can have an extremely negative impact on the economy of their countries. In many of these smaller countries in the Caribbean and Central America, their GDPs depend, their economic future depend on a steady flow of remittances from the United States and maybe even Europe. And if those quantities of dollars decrease substantially, it could have a catastrophic effect on their national economies.
Well, I'm sure, Sergio, that there are many people who are listening who are thinking, okay, well, this is an interesting story. It could be bad for economies, you know, in Central America or the Caribbean. But they're probably saying, what does this have to do with me and why should I care? And does it have any impact on me here in the United States if I'm not tied to the immigrant community at all? So what's the answer?
Well, I think we are all tied to the immigrant community in the United States, whether we know it or not or whether we like to admit it to ourselves or not. I think the most important trend that we may be identifying with this is that if Latin American immigrants stop sending remittances to their families, it is their first step in terms of a potential exodus from the United States. I think that if we see over the next few years millions and millions of Latin Americans deciding to go home instead of continuing to stay in the United States and work, it will have a catastrophic impact on the American economy. And I think that is something that, it goes without saying, would impact on the quality of life of all Americans.
Although, of course, there are people who say that the economic catastrophe that we're facing now is, in some people's view, being created by the presence of undocumented immigrants. And you would say,
well, I think that point of view does not fit in well with reality. I think if you were to remove the 20 million Latin American immigrants that are today in the United States, again, agriculture, construction, the service industry, the hotels, the restaurants, much of the tourism industry in the United States would go belly up, and no one can argue that that would have a very negative impact on the American economy. Most people do not like to think of it that way, but that's the reality.
Well, thanks for that information, Sergio.
Very good, Maria. Thank you again for inviting me to your program.
Sergio Bendixson is president of Bendixson and Associates, a multilingual, multi-ethnic research group based in Florida. So, how are Mexicans being affected by the decline in remittances? In 2006, Mexican immigrants in the United States sent $23 billion home, and the potential loss of that income could spell trouble for their own economy. Contributor Monica Lopez sent us this story from Mexico City on how that country is dealing with the possibility of remittances going down.
Mexico City is the center of government and commerce for the nation of Mexico. The sprawling capital is home to over 19 million people, and for all the wealth in the city, the majority of its residents struggle to stay out of poverty. For many of them, extra money sent by relatives living in the United States is the only way to make ends meet. Antonio Rosales Medina works as a security guard at a bookstore. He says even the worst salary in the U.S. is better than what can be made in Mexico.
Pero a comparación de cómo vivimos aquí, no.
You can't compare the United States to how we live here in Mexico, because who can live on a minimum wage here? Nobody. That's why people migrate to the United States.
Por eso emigra la gente a Estados Unidos.
And Mexican families are not the only ones that have benefited from remittances. The government, too, has also benefited from increased taxes and a more stable economy. At a recent conference on remittances, Rosa Marquez, a member of the Secretariat for Rural Development and Community Equity, spoke of the importance of the money sent home by migrants.
Durante los últimos años, y el Distrito Federal es de las entidades que reciben más de mil millones de dólares anuales por este concepto.
During the past few years, the federal district estimates that it has received billions of dollars annually in this form. In the past year, $1.5 billion were received. This is why it's important to jointly look for strategies that will allow us to capitalize on these resources and to find just conditions for migrant workers to send money to their families.
Para los trabajadores migratorios, para que envíen su dinero a sus familias.
But some immigrant activists say that the government has become overly dependent on remittances. Marta Sanchez Soler is the founder of the immigrant advocacy group Movimiento Mesoamericano.
We call them diezmos. Diezmos in Spanish means the 10% that churches ask to their people. In old times, you had to pay your diezmo or you'd be excommunicated. Most migrants send at least 10% of their hard-earned money home. And that money has not only kept families eating, but has also contained social protest in Mexico. And that's why governments are so for remittances. They want the money here. Otherwise, people would go hungry and people would protest.
Sanchez says the government has tried to make structural changes in the economy. But the prescriptions of global lending institutions, calling for increased privatization and foreign investment, have only worsened poverty levels and inequality. And now that remittances are dropping, with raids and deportations increasing in the United States, Sanchez says it's only going to make the situation worse in Mexico.
The ones that have been deported, the families were supported by the money that they were sending. Now they come and they don't not only don't send money, but they eat also. And so it's one more expense in the household. It's generating a lot of stress in families because the men come back or the women come back, but they don't find work. So it's just one more mouth to feed, as they say.
A recent survey by the Inter-American Development Bank projects a further decrease in remittances. The Mexican government says it supports transnational community efforts to lower the cost of wiring money home as a way to counter the drop. In the meantime, Mexicans and their families will be forced to find other solutions to make ends meet. For Latino USA, I'm Monica Lopez in Mexico City.
In a minute, from the barrio to Broadway, the multi-ethnic musical extravaganza called In the Heights, just nominated for the most Tony Awards this season. That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Last summer, In the Heights, the musical story of life in New York's Washington Heights Dominican neighborhood, had yet to debut on Broadway when I spoke with its creator and star, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Essentially, it's a love story, but it's also a story about immigration, moving and going and coming, dreams, borders being crossed, gentrification. You know, you really wanted to cover a lot of territory because this is the Latino reality in New York now.
I think at the end of the day, the best musicals are really about very simple things, and I think our musical strives to be about home. But it's not Wizard of Oz, there's no place like home. I think it's complicated because some people are running away from home and some people are looking for it.
The new home for In the Heights is now on the Great White Way on Broadway. And just this week, it was announced that Lin-Manuel Miranda's high-energy portrayal of Latino life in the city was nominated for a breakthrough 13 Tony Awards, the most for this season. Joining me on Latino USA again is Lin-Manuel Miranda, the driving force behind In the Heights, nominated for Best Actor in a Musical, and his co-star Olga Meredith, who plays Abuela Claudia. She's nominated as Best Feature Actress in a Musical. Welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you.
What's it like? I mean, Lin, now you really are on Broadway.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, it's quite a head trip. I mean, it's amazing that we're on Broadway, but it feels like home on Broadway because it's such a big show. And I think and all of my favorite musicals are big Broadway musicals: Fiddler on the Roof, Chorus Line, and West Side Story. So it feels amazing. To be honest, when you see the quotes from the critics up on our marquee and those pictures, There's nothing like it.
Olga, you have been around a little bit longer than Lin.
A little bit.
And we had you on the show when you were starring in Mamma Mia.
Right.
So Broadway is not new to you. But when you think about the fact that you're working on a show that was written by literally this kid, you know, I mean, he was, I just love that. I mean, you are.
Well, he's an old soul. He's a kid, but he's got an old soul. It's been very infectious because Lin has so much energy and all these kids. So it's really affected me in a positive way. And it's been a wonderful experience for me, really.
Can I say that I just feel the same? I feel like Olga's the one with the youthful energy and I'm getting it from her. Sometimes I get up on the stage and I feel 85 years old. And then Olga comes bouncing up on stage because she does this sort of Tai Chi thing before she gets up there.
Qigong.
And she's kind of bouncing around. She's the one who fills me with youthful energy.
Oh, so I feel that's like nice.
When you think about the fact that this play, it has a great appeal to Latino audiences who kind of get it because of the music, because of the language. But you think about the audience that is beyond Latino, immigrants, New Yorkers. Why has it taken, why has this play caught on so much?
Because it transcends the Latino family. It's about family and community and home. And everybody has that. I mean, when I leave the stage door, I have people from Iowa and Kansas and Canada and different countries, coming up to me and saying, we love the show. And you reminded me of my grandmother and it reminded me of my family. So it's not just a Latino story. It is a Latino story, but it can be any family.
Yeah. The Latino story is the latest chapter in the American experience, in the American dream of, we get here,
right.
We do the jobs no one's willing to do so that our kids can do better than we did. And I think everyone in this country has come here from somewhere. And so, we had I saw the show once. We had my understudy on so I could take notes during previews. And there was a 70-year-old Jewish lady behind me saying, I lived in Washington Heights when it was all Jewish, and that's exactly what it was like. And responded to the story, and it didn't matter that she wasn't Latino. And,
right.
And she got the Spanish, even if she didn't literally understand what it was, she got the gist, and it spoke to her because it reminded her of that struggle.
I'm just wondering, when you talk about the Latino experience being kind of the latest chapter in our American history, and suddenly I just found myself writing down backlash, because I'm wondering, there is an anti-immigrant sentiment out there. There is an anti-Latino sentiment out there.
Absolutely.
something's going on for you. I mean, what? Go ahead, tell
me.
Yeah, well,
no, I mean, it's and you know, there's actually a line Sonny has in the show that we added between Off Broadway and Broadway. Sonny gets in 96,000 gets asked what he would do if he had $96,000, and he says, "The rents are escalating. The rich are penetrating. We pay our corporations when we should be demonstrating. What about immigration? Politicians be hating. Racism in this nation's gone from latent to blatant." And one of the things that I love about that is Sonny in that song is the only one who doesn't talk about himself. He doesn't talk about buying a house. He doesn't talk about getting away.
Right.
He talks about uplifting his community. But because he's a kid, they go, "You are so cute." And everyone laughs and you keep going. So we get our political point in and we get to, you know, laugh about it too, because hope has been relegated to youth. And you know, I think it's great that in this climate where there is anti-immigration sentiment, this show is a reminder that we're people and that we are humans and that we have just as much a right to be here.
What does it do to you, Olga, to know that, you know, people are leaving the show incredibly hopeful about our future? Just seeing you guys on Broadway is a hopeful thing.
I love it, and I think it's very necessary in these times that we're living, in these economic times and these political times and these corporate times. People need hope right now, and if we can give that to them in our own way, then you know, we've accomplished something, I think.
Lynn, for you, hope?
It's very gratifying because I know, as someone who's seen a lot of musicals, it's not easily won. If it's too sentimental or it's too cheesy, you just feel like, oh, well, that was a nice musical. It has to be, you know, I love Frank Capra movies, and Tommy Kail, our director, loves Frank Capra movies. And, you know, that end of It's a Wonderful Life is that much sweeter because you see how hard this guy's life has been and how many regrets he carries with him. And then we actually quote It's a Wonderful Life at the end of the show. At one point when, you know, I don't want to give it away, but Usnavi has this sort of epiphany. And at one point he goes, "It's a wonderful life that I've known. Merry Christmas, you old building alone. I'm home." It's our little Capra reference because for it to really be uplifting, you have to earn it. You have to go through it. And that's what we've tried to do.
Thank you both so much for your work, for your commitment to the arts, to creation, to creativity, and to the show. It's just amazing.
Thank you for
having
us.
It's a pleasure, Maria. Thank you.
Lin-Manuel Miranda and Olga Meredith. You can see them both on In the Heights. It's at the Richard Rogers Theater in New York City. More information can be found at intheheightsthemusical.com. Gracias.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Latino USA was produced this week by Benjamin Jacob, Angela Maldonado, Alex Avila, and Walter Morgan. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. We had help this week from Shannon Novak in Miami and Paul Franklin at KUHF in Houston. To listen to our podcasts, go to latinousa.org or look for us on iTunes. Our listener comment line is 800-535-5533. Our email is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the Center for Mexican American Studies, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. The American Psychiatric Association, physicians working to help people maintain healthy minds and live healthy lives. Real stories at healthyminds.org. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring. Catalog at 1-800-FLOORING. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio, this is Latino USA.
Arizona, cowboys in the Grand Canyon, right? Then you haven't seen us lately. Arizona, come see the new Wild West.
Arizona. Sure, it can be a great place to visit, but you might want to think twice if you're an undocumented immigrant or if the sheriff there happens to think you look like one.
I have been profiled. I've been asked to provide documentation of my citizenship.
A crackdown on undocumented immigrants by the Sheriff's Office of Maricopa County, Arizona, has many complaining of abuse. But the sheriff says he's getting results.
I'm getting tired of everybody saying they don't commit any crimes. I just told you 20% of the people booked in our jail are illegal.
The way you look at me, why do you think I'm not looking?
and a wonderful new jazz voice on the scene, Esperanza Spalding. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. More than 1,100 immigration laws have been proposed so far this year by state legislatures across the country. Joining us to discuss this and other news of the week affecting the Latino community is Univision's national news anchor, Maria Elena Salinas. Hey, Maria Elena.
Hi, Maria. Nice to talk to you.
All right. So the National Conference of State Legislators, which has basically been tracking these proposed state immigration legislation movements since 1997, says that about 1,100 state immigration laws were proposed in the first quarter of 2008. I almost thought 1,100 and that was going to cover the years from 1997 to 2008. That's 1,100 new laws proposed in the first quarter of 2008. What's the story here? Local government says we're gonna take over this issue because the federal government just isn't doing anything?
Well, it seems that way, Maria. You know, politics has been getting in the way of anything being accomplished in Congress on the immigration issues. In the first quarter of this year, there have been 1,106 proposed laws, to be exact, dealing with immigration in 44 states. And it's even more impressive when you figure that in 1997, there were only 200 bills. So there's more interest on the part of the states to get more laws out there, and they range anywhere from law enforcement, driver's license, education, health services. So I guess, you know, this is expected to continue as long as there's no movement in the federal government toward immigration reform, and, you know, there's no indication that anything's going to happen until well after the presidential election.
All right. Well, speaking about presidential politics, May 20th was Cuban Independence Day. Republican candidate John McCain used the occasion to attack Barack Obama, saying he continues to attack him on the issue of his inexperience with foreign policy. But the bigger issue, the story that we've been reporting on, continues to loom out there, is the changing nature of the Latino vote and the demographics there. Everyone thinking, again, strong Republican Cuban vote. That's not the story anymore.
No, Maria, that's not the story. And, you know, while John McCain is in Miami presenting his Cuban policy, should he make it to the White House, it turns out that Cuba is no longer the main issue for Latinos in Florida. For the first time, there's more Hispanics registered as Democrats than Republicans in Florida. And this was the only state in the country where Hispanic Republicans outnumbered Hispanic Democrats. So now that's changing. And the reason for that change is basically demographics. More Latinos from South and Central America, but also a younger generation of Cuban Americans that don't necessarily feel that strong commitment to the Republican Party like their parents and grandparents. So when John McCain comes here to say that he would like to continue the embargo against Cuba, support dissidents, increase funding for Radio Martí and TV Martí, he really did get a lot of applause from the traditional Cuban-American voters, but he needs to expand the message if he wants to get the Latino vote in November.
All right, Maria Elena, that's McCain. But what about frontrunner Barack Obama? How is he playing out in Florida and his relationship to Latino voters there? What are you seeing?
I think he needs to do some work because, like you said before, McCain criticized him for saying he'd be willing to sit down and talk with leaders of Cuba, Venezuela, and Iran. That position doesn't go over very well in South Florida, especially with so many Venezuelans here that are so opposed to Hugo Chavez. Cuban and Venezuelans really do get a lot of sympathy from the other Latinos.
All right, Maria Elena, moving on. Finally, some sketchy reports, some emails that I've gotten, some urgent communications about incursions by the Mexican military into the Zapatista-held regions in southern Mexico. What do we know about this story? How serious is it?
Well, there have been reports, Maria, by members of the indigenous communities in Chiapas that this week there was an increase in military presence in the region. I think there were reports of military helicopters flying over the area, even some vehicles with military personnel and federal agents from AFI who went to homes of alleged supporters of Zapatista rebels. You know, it apparently happened more than once in a short period of time. When the military representatives were confronted, they said it was just routine operations. Why are they so concerned with this military presence? I guess it's because, you know, there's been so much violence in the last 2 years, especially in the last few months, as part of President Felipe Calderón's fight against the drug cartels, and thousands of people have been killed. You know, there's also U.S. taxpayer dollars that could be involved in all this, since President Bush is pushing for his Mérida initiative, which is very similar to Plan Colombia, that provides funds to help governments fight against drugs. But, you know, these funds always end up being used also to fight against dissidents or opponents of the government. the media will be keeping a close eye on that and human rights organizations as well.
And so will we. Thanks for joining us, Maria Elena.
Thank you, Maria.
Maria Elena Salinas is a syndicated columnist and national news anchor for Univision, the Spanish language television network. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
I think Arizona has become the experiment room for anti-immigrant legislation, and people are saying Arizona is becoming the state of hate. We have to change this.
That's Lidia Guzman, a resident of Maricopa County in Arizona, where state legislators have moved forward with a variety of laws to crack down on what they see as a criminal threat to society. They say it's undocumented immigrants. Couple this with the Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who's made arresting and deporting people one of his top priorities, and it's no wonder that the state is now considered by many as ground zero for the immigration debate. From Phoenix, Latino USA's Andrew Stelzer has our story.
The list of anti-immigrant legislation is long in Arizona, with new proposals introduced all the time. Prop 200 eliminated scholarships or financial aid for students unable to prove residency. A law penalizing employers who hire undocumented workers came into effect on January 1st. Laws are stricter than in most states, and with all laws, the level of enforcement is what determines their real effect. That's where Sheriff Joe Arpaio comes in.
Hello? Okay, what happened? You arrested a guy outside, and what did he do? So you think they're illegals and coyotes?
Arpaio has been the elected sheriff of Maricopa County, which includes the city of Phoenix, for the past 16 years. But over the past few years, Arpaio has become a national hero for the movement against illegal immigration. He says it must be stopped at all costs.
Because nobody would enforce the law. The business people came to me, begged me, please, Sheriff, come in here and do something. These illegals are destroying our business, and I am the elected sheriff.
In 2007, Arpaio had 160 of his deputies trained to enforce federal immigration laws, making the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department the largest local force to do so. Soon after, he began what he calls crime suppression operations, but what many simply refer to as his sweeps, where dozens of officers descend on a neighborhood, pulling over people in cars and on the streets, and asking for proof of U.S. citizenship. Arpaio defends the program as preempting crime.
I just had, in last month in Guadalupe, an adult rape of a 15-year-old. Last week, we had a guy rape an 11-year-old, made her pregnant and with a disease. Another illegal. Would you like to keep going down every day what illegals are doing?
But increasingly, the Latino and Native American community say they too are being targeted for looking like undocumented immigrants.
I have been profiled. I've been pulled over in my car. I've been detained. I've been asked to provide documentation of my citizenship.
Rick Romero was born and raised in Phoenix. He says the tactics of Arpaio and his supporters have divided the community.
I think this, in comparison, historically, would be what Selma, Alabama was in the 1950s, the civil rights movement. I think what's happening here in Maricopa County is ground zero for the immigrant rights movement.
According to Phoenix Mayor Phil Gordon, many residents now actually fear the police and avoid calling when help is needed. Gordon has come out in opposition to Arpaio's sweeps, and he's asked the FBI and Justice Department to investigate the sheriff for possible civil rights violations.
A third of our community is Latino, and that's an important segment of our population. If it's terrorized, legal or not legal, that they're afraid to come out and testify because the sheriff's going to arrest them. It is counterproductive to the safety of this community.
In response, several anti-immigrant groups, of which there are an increasing number in Arizona, have launched a petition drive to recall Mayor Gordon. While the recall effort seems likely to fail, the mayor's popularity pales in comparison to the sheriff's. Mayor Gordon says he believes Arpaio is busting immigrants to cater to the voters. The sheriff is up for re-election this fall.
Whether the majority of the people support an individual or not is not the question with respect to whether the actions are legal or not. It's whether the actions are legal.
Arpaio denies politics is behind his crackdown, saying he has overwhelming support.
So I don't need this to get elected. And I've been on many, many, many national shows, and I'm going to tell you, I have the temple of the people of this country, because every time I'm on, I get calls and letters all the time saying, thank you, Sheriff, for what you are doing.
But there are signs that a backlash is growing against the harsh tactics. The unincorporated town of Guadalupe is considering cutting its contract with the sheriff's department altogether. After a two-day sweep in the beginning of April, the mayor of the largely Latino and Native American town of only 5,500 people said it doesn't make sense that they pay the sheriff's department more than $1 million to harass its citizens. Santino Bernasconi runs Centro de Amistad, a health center in Guadalupe.
There's drug houses in Guadalupe. His police officers have been here for years. They haven't closed them down. So he's got time to be stopping people because you've got a broken headlight, but he doesn't have time to provide the services that are much more serious.
In addition to his critics, Arpaio is now being challenged by the governor's office. An estimated 48,000 individuals charged with or convicted of felonies, including violent crimes, are currently on the loose in Maricopa County. Last week, Governor Janet Napolitano took $1.5 million in funding from the sheriff's immigrant raids and redirected it to a new state-run fugitive task force. For Latino USA, I'm Andrew Stelzer, reporting from Phoenix.
Careless Detention, a recent four-part series done by Washington Post reporters Dana Priest and Amy Goldstein, takes a closer look at how government officials provide, or more often than not, don't provide, health care to the roughly 33,000 detainees currently held in immigration custody. Dana Priest joins me now. Welcome to Latino USA, Dana.
Glad to be here.
You have covered a lot of stories in Washington. You've run the gamut. But when you were covering this story about immigrants, healthcare, and detention, what was the most shocking thing for you?
The sense of not having any leverage over the system just permeated the stories. And what I mean by that is, once you're inside these facilities, you really are pretty invisible. There is not the same kind of access to lawyers or outside advocates that there is in the regular penal system. Then there's the language barrier. And when you're dealing with detainees with medical issues, this really does become a problem. And often we heard frustrations on the part of the healthcare workers that one of them said it was like playing charades with a foreigner. You could not tell if they had a medical issue what it really was. You could be pointing to your head and they could say yes, but then you wouldn't really know what that meant.
So when you get down to the issue of the medical treatment of these immigrant detainees, what kind of issues did you uncover in terms of who should be accountable for these lives in these detention centers, some of which are privately run?
The bottom line is it's the U.S. government. But then when you say, well, who in the U.S. government is where it becomes very complicated because of a reorganization that happened after September 11th, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, and then the creation of a new INS, ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement. It's got a small unit called DIHS, the Division of Immigrant Health Services. This is an agency that really got lost, set almost adrift after 9/11. Became such a low priority and then really was not treated as importantly, perhaps, as it should have been, given that the numbers of detainees in these facilities tripled since 9/11. So you had, because of the change in immigration laws and effort to carry them out more fully, you had a deluge of immigrants come into these facilities. And not a lot of forethought given to, well, what happens when that happens?
You had someone, a deputy warden from a county prison in Pennsylvania housing these immigrant detainees, who basically said that if there was a way to deny medical care to these detainees, it was denied. If it was able to be delayed, it was delayed. Everything that DIHS did to make it harder to treat these detainees was what was set up.
Well, part of what they did, faced with budget issues, is say, well, we can't do all this, nor do we want to do all this, so we're going to deny, we're going to scrutinize, and we're going to ultimately cut back. And that's really what they did. So how do they do that? In the case of Francisco Castaneda, who died recently of cancer, they repeatedly denied his and his healthcare provider's requests for a biopsy for cancer for 8 to 10 months. I can't remember which one. And the judge has found that his care was so neglectful, he said it went miles beyond neglect, and has really taken the government to task for denying what should have been given to him and was not, in part because of the effort to maintain or cut costs.
What's the broader issue? Why should the rest of Americans who are not immigrants, who don't have any family members who are coming here, well, why should our listeners care?
Well, we have laws that say that immigrants in detention deserve this sort of standard medical care. So if they are not given it, it's against the law. Now, as a human being, regardless of what the law says, what we wanted to do is just tell you what we found, and you can decide for yourself whether that not only meets the law, but does it meet your ethics or morals as a human being.
Thank you so much for your reporting, Dana.
Thank you.
Washington Post reporters Dana Priest and Amy Goldstein's entire series, Careless Detention, can be read at WashingtonPost.com.
New state and local laws coupled with increased federal enforcement have led to a situation that bears more than a passing resemblance to that of African Americans dehumanized and killed under Jim Crow. Call it Juan Crow.
Commentator Roberto Lobato.
Consider the case of Justine Mancha. The wiry, freckle-faced high school junior has toiled in drought-dry onion fields alongside her mother to eke out a living in Reidsville, Georgia. From the living room of the battered trailer she and her mother call home, Mancha told me of an early morning raid by ICE agents on that home. Her mother had gone out, and as Justine got ready for school, heavily armed men burst into her living room, screaming that they were looking for illegals, Mexicans. After interrogating her, the agents determined that Justine and her mother were the wrong kind of Mexicans. They were U.S. citizens. Justine was not deported, but her nightmares, the twitches in her arms, and her fear of people in uniform mirror the terror experienced by thousands of immigrants at home, at work, and in detention centers. Young Latinos attend schools that teach them about Jim Crow while giving them a daily dose of Juan Crow. And so, like those who defeated Jim Crow, we must destroy Juan Crow if we are ever to live in a just society.
Roberto Lobato is a New York-based writer with New America Media and The Nation magazine. In a minute, bassist, vocalist, and composer Esperanza Spalding, coming up on Latino USA, No Se Vayan. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Jazz great and bassist Milt Hinton often said that the bass is the atlas of jazz, carrying all other instruments on his shoulders. That can definitely be said of rising star Esperanza Spalding, who uses her prolific skills as a bassist and now a vocalist to lift her band to new musical heights.
The way you look at me, why do you think I'm not looking? Tell
Esperanza Spalding has anchored the bands of such greats as Pat Metheny, Herbie Hancock, and one of my closest friends, pianist Michel Camilo. And the 23-year-old is also the youngest faculty member ever to teach at the Berklee College of Music. She has a new album out now, simply titled Esperanza. And we're pleased to have Esperanza join us on Latino USA. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So you are a bassist and a vocalist and a composer. You're 23 years old.
That's right.
You grew up in Portland, Oregon, which is not exactly the center of, you know, jazz.
Right.
I mean, there's good music out there, but it's not kind of seen as the place. So how'd you end up producing your own CD and with this very unique jazz style?
It's funny. There's a weird kind of juxtaposition in Portland between the fact that there's real no venues and there's no infrastructure to support like live jazz. But then there's also this other side where there's so many phenomenal musicians of all different walks, of all different genres and idioms. Anything that you pretty much could ask for is somewhere there. And because I think there's not a lot of work, there's just this type of community and mentorship and camaraderie that I've never really found anywhere else. So as I ventured into the world of the bass and the world of jazz, they were just right there kind of leading me along this journey.
Did you always know, you know, when you were a young girl, I'm going to be a singer? And then when you got older, you said, and I'm going to be a jazz singer.
Not really. No. Singing is such art, you know. Many people claim to be singers. I'm one of them, and I don't really think I am. I mean, it takes years to really master the art of emoting and drawing people in, you know.
Yeah, but when you're 23 and you've been able to kind of develop your own sound. I mean, like, for example, in I Adore You, which has got that really, you know, you've tapped into the Brazilian thing, but it's not, like, too overwhelming. It doesn't feel like it's, like, all, I mean, it's clearly a Brazilian, a north-south mix.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, for sure. Part of the reason that, I mean, I feel very free. Like, when I'm doing music, when I'm writing or rehearsing or playing, I don't feel like I'm supposed to sound like any idiom. And maybe part of that freedom comes from not seeing myself as a singer, per se. So, I mean, kind of, I can do whatever I want, you know? It's like, that sounds so funny. But I feel like that.
At such a young age, you had some hard times when you were growing up in Portland, Oregon. And you talk a lot about your mom. One of the many things that she did was she worked as a labor organizer. Tell us a little bit about that. And of course, everyone wants to know your name. It's a gorgeous name. People who speak Spanish know it immediately what it means. But if you speak English, you don't know what Esperanza means. So what does Esperanza mean?
Esperanza means hope. That's what the name means. The world is helpless sorrow. No hope for a bright tomorrow. But I'm not sure enough to keep it up. No. My mother lived for many years in Mexico and spent a lot of time. She taught in Mexican schools, and she worked with movements of Cesar Chavez, organizing the farm workers unions. in California. So she's spent a lot of time around Hispanic culture, and she speaks Spanish. And before I was born, she decided that she wanted to name me Hope. It's like that's what she had envisioned for me, that I would bring her hope and that I would bring hope to, I guess, people. I don't know.
Well, you do, you definitely, I mean, just the way you look, you've got a real sense of, you know, a kind of the racial balance of the future. I mean, you're think African-American, I mean, what is your racial background?
Yeah, that's a complicated one. Isn't that amazing?
I mean, you don't have to answer it, but the thing is that it just feels like with all of your music and kind of the look that you have, it's very kind of retro because it's definitely, right. You know, you've got an Afro, but then it's really all about the future.
My father was African-American. And my mother is Welsh, Native American, Hispanic, and she has a little bit of African American too. The music is kind of an analogy for what happens with people of mixed descent, and that you can't depend as much on your ancestry for your identity. You know, like many people are realizing that one like lineage of music isn't really enough for them to express who they are. So you really are starting to hear a type of music that's based less on specific backgrounds, at least musical backgrounds, and more just kind of on this mix of anything goes. And that's really cool. I think that's a cool place. And I like that you identified that. It is a good place to be going towards the future, for sure.
Thank you so much, Esperanza.
Thank you.
Good luck with all your music.
Thank you very much.
Esperanza Spalding's self-titled release is available from Heads Up International. And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. Gracias. Production support comes from KUT Radio, the Center for Mexican American Studies, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. The Gruber Family Foundation, for support of NPR's international coverage. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring. Catalog at 1-800-FLOORING. This is NPR, National Public Radio.